From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
His own lonely impunity is rank. It smells to heaven. If it is allowed to persist, then we shall shamefully vindicate the ancient philosopher Anacharsis, who maintained that laws were like cobwebs, strong enough to detain only the weak and too weak to hold the strong. In the name of innumerable victims, known and unknown, it is time for justice to take a hand.
Today, Christopher Hitchens debates the question, should Henry Kissinger be put on trial, as President Bush calls for the extradition of Milosevic to The Hague. And after Bob Kerry admits his involvement in a massacre, Human Rights Watch calls for an investigation and potential prosecution for war crimes. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The city of Philadelphia agreed yesterday to allow supporters of death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal to hold a two-night rally in the center plaza of City Hall this weekend. After filing a lawsuit and appearing in federal court yesterday, organizers said they will hold a vigil from Friday night to Sunday night in support of the former journalist and Black Panther. The rally is timed to coincide with the 16th anniversary of the 1985 MOVE bombing, in which police firebombed a row house, killing 11 people, a number of them children, and burning two city blocks. Philadelphia had initially denied the group's petition to camp overnight and demanded a $1 million insurance policy, which the group provided. Members of Congress aren't happy about the U.S. being expelled from the U.N. Human Rights Commission. The House is expected to retaliate today for the U.S. being kicked off the body by voting to withhold back dues the U.S. owes the U.N. unless it gets the seat back. The Bush administration is urging lawmakers not to withhold the money. State Department spokesperson Dick Armey said congressional approval of such a proposal would be extremely damaging to the U.S. ability to cooperate in multilateral organizations. The mother of an unarmed Black man shot dead by a white police officer in Cincinnati has filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the officer and the city. Officer Stephen Roach pleaded innocent to misdemeanor charges on Wednesday in connection with the shooting. And more than 1,000 people protesting everything from environmental destruction to the 40-hour work week, marched through Honolulu's main tourist area yesterday to register their opposition to the meeting of the Asian Development Bank there. The marchers, led by Hawaiian rights activists carrying state flags, included labor union groups, church groups, and environmental activists. The protesters delivered a written set of demands to the Asian Development President, calling for the multilateral bank to suspend financing for water and farming projects in the Philippines, Thailand, and Sri Lanka. They argued would harm the environment and local residents.
They'd ask, where were my parents, my father, my mother? would not answer a thing. I see you playing there, Nuremberg 47. Started to sprout and grow. Gradually I understood what that verdict meant to me. When there are crimes that I can see and know, and now I also know what it is to be charged with mass guilt. Once in a lifetime is enough for me. No, I couldn't take it for a second time, and that's why I am here today. Even to May 25th, day of our protest, put a small balance weight on the other side. Hopefully someday my contribution to peace will help just a bit to turn the tide. Perhaps I can tell my children six, later on their own children, but at least in the future they need not be silent when they're asked, where was your mother?
Annie DeFranco singing Pete Seeger's song, My Name is Lisa Kalvalage. This about a German immigrant turned activist who protested U.S. shipments of napalm to Vietnam in 1965. As we debate the issue of war crimes today, there are those who say that the recent revelations of Bob Kerry's involvement in the killing of women and children in Vietnam is an inevitable product of war. But in a few minutes, we're going to talk to the real Lisa Kalvalage, who now lives in California and is 78 years old, about not going to war and the path she chose to take. We'll then be speaking with Christopher Hitchens and hear him engaged in a debate about the issue of Henry Kissinger and whether he should be charged with war crimes. But yesterday, President Bush told Yugoslav President Vojislav Kostunica that U.S. financial aid to Belgrade would depend on cooperation with the War Crimes Tribunal at The Hague. The Hague's indicted former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic for crimes against humanity. Last month, President Kostunica refused outright to hand over Milosevic to The Hague, but yesterday he said he was pushing to have his country's law changed by the end of the month so that Belgrade could cooperate with the tribunal. The revelations of former Senator Bob Kerry's involvement in the massacre in Vietnam have raised the question of war crimes committed by our own civilians. And earlier this week, Human Rights Watch called for an investigation of the former Nebraska senator, now president of the New School, and possible prosecution of him and others involved in those kinds of atrocities. Today, we're going to talk about his case. We're going to talk also about Henry Kissinger. But before we do that, we'll look at the question of the International Criminal Court. The U.S. was recently voted off the U.N. Human Rights Commission in Geneva, and it is believed one of the reasons is because of the U.S.'s opposition to the International Criminal Court. In July of 1998, 150 countries negotiated the ICC in Rome. 139 have signed so far, 30 have ratified it. Another 30 are necessary to put the court into being. President Clinton signed the treaty in December, but the Bush administration is not sympathetic. Secretary of State Colin Powell said last week the treaty was flawed and that the U.S. would not ratify it. And Senator Jesse Helms and other conservatives in Congress have warned that the U.S. will retaliate against any country who ratifies the treaty by withholding U.S. foreign assistance. We're joined on the phone right now by Lee Casey, who is a partner at Baker & Hostetler in Washington, D.C., and author of a series of editorials in the Wall Street Journal, Europe, around the issue of the International Criminal Court. Reid Brody is with us, Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch, a strong supporter of that court. Lee Casey, can you explain why you support the Bush administration in fighting ratification of the International Criminal Court?
Sure. The court, as an institution, would be, you know, profoundly undemocratic. It's unelected, unaccountable. It would be a political football and used more to discipline the use of U.S. power than it would to actually prosecute the perpetrators of war crimes. And frankly, our participation would be fundamentally unconstitutional.
In what way?
Well, the court does not offer the minimum guarantees provided for in the Bill of Rights to criminal defendants. There are no juries, no protection against double jeopardy, secret witnesses, secret trials. There's a whole series of things that, while arguably meeting international standards, come nowhere near the minimum standards that we take for granted.
Reid Brody of Human Rights Watch.
It's important, Amy, that you juxtaposed the issues of Slobodan Milosevic, Bob Kerry, and the International Criminal Court, because that's what this is about. Today, nations all over the world, South Africa, Chile, Argentina, Serbia, Rwanda, are struggling to come to terms with crimes committed in their past. And the U.S., in many ways, has been a strong supporter of justice and of international justice, except when it comes to the possibility of an American one day being judged before a court. This court provides some of the most strong guarantees of impartiality and fairness. The judges of the International Criminal Court will be elected from the world's leading jurists by the states who ratify the treaty, by the Argentinas and the Swedens and the South Africas of the world, not by the Iraqs and the Chinas. There is no, if an American commits a war crime or genocide or crime against humanity, it will be in the first instance for the United States courts to bring that person to justice. The ICC will only have complementary jurisdiction where national justice is unwilling or unable to bring that person to trial. There are due process guarantees. It is correct that there is no trial by jury, but Americans who commit crimes abroad, which is what would be in question here, in many other countries don't have a right to a trial by jury.
Lee Casey, your response.
Well, a couple of responses. With respect to the abroad issue, this court, were we to sign on to it, would actually have jurisdiction over crimes committed in the United States entirely, where, of course, American citizens are entitled to the full panoply of Bill of Rights protections. As to the judges of this court, yes, some of them might well come from places like Sweden, but if you look at the countries that have also signed on, they include places like Algeria, Cambodia, Iran, Nigeria, Sudan, and Syria, all of which have been implicated in judicial murders and other. I mean, these countries simply do not share our view of what the rule of law means. And I think we will have, were we to be a part of this regime, only as much say as any one of those or any other country that that ratifies this treaty. So it is, frankly, a real real danger of being used in a political way, as the Human Rights Commission has been in the last week against the United States.
Amy, I just want to respond. So what Mr. Casey is saying is that if an American commits genocide in the United States, or crimes against humanity in the United States, and the hypothesis then is that he's not brought to justice in the United States, which I already find to be very unlikely, then that is correct. If if he's not brought to justice in the United States after having committed genocide in the United States, the International Criminal Court could seek his prosecution, and in that case, he wouldn't have a jury trial. But I find that such an unlikely hypothetical to base an argument on. And if we look at the courts that are in existence today, the International Court of Justice, the International Courts for Rwanda, and Yugoslavia, it would be very hard to argue that they have been used for anti-American bias.
Well, speaking about the rule of law, the idea that this country abides by it and the other countries don't, this issue of Bob Kerry that has just come out and is gaining momentum, the revelations that a commando team led by the ex-Nebraska senator killed civilians during the Vietnam War. I wanted to address for a minute. He held the news conference at the Sheraton Hotel last week to deal with the revelations that were coming out in the New York Times and 60 Minutes, too. And I asked him about the issue of war crimes in a war crimes tribunal, and I wanted to get both of your reactions to it.
According to international law, it's not just people like you who pull the trigger and kill civilians who bear different levels of responsibility, but it's the architects of war, like in Vietnam, who set up a policy where large areas of a country are free fire zones that lead to the deaths of, in the case of Vietnam, or 2 million Vietnamese, largely civilians. The media is making a lot of this question of whether it was an atrocity or a war crime. What do you think of setting up a war crimes tribunal that would bring people, perhaps like you, but more importantly, the architects like Henry Kissinger, before it, and then the decision would be made about
Again, it's your I'm not prepared to talk about where I'm going to go or where this ought to go. I really am not, and
You have more than 30 years to think about.
Well, I'm sorry. You know, for the first 10 years of my life, I was just trying to figure out how to get healthy again.
What about the whole country getting healthy?
Well, at some point, I hope to help the whole country get beyond the Vietnam War. But right now, I'm just trying to get a private memory public. And I have not gone as far as you're suggesting in trying to figure out where else I should,
one follow-up.
That was Senator Kerry, former Senator Bob Kerry, talking about the revelations that he was involved with the killing of more than a dozen people in the Mekong Delta on February 25th, 1969. Reed Brody, your organization, has called for an investigation of this Navy SEAL operation, and if it warrants it, prosecutions. What do you think of his response?
But we've also called for a larger investigation. Senator Kerry, in his defense, said that his troops were acting in accordance with standing orders that made his part of the Mekong Delta a free fire zone, in which civilians were considered legitimate targets, as well as, he says, specific instructions to his unit to kill anyone encountered rather than take prisoners. That doesn't defend him, but it does suggest that there may have been a larger policy that was a war crime. If Senator Kerry was instructed not to take prisoners, then he wasn't being instructed to commit war crimes. And what we have called for is a full investigation to see whether that was the case. We don't know the facts of what happened in Senator Kerry's case, and we believe they should be investigated. We also believe that there needs to be a wider look at whether or not there was a systematic policy of committing war crimes.
Attorney Lee Casey.
Well, I think it's very easy to lay these kind of charges and very difficult to disprove them, particularly, 30 years later. Obviously, if what happened on that night was that Senator Kerry ordered his men to round up a group of individuals he knew to be civilians and then massacred them, that would constitute a war crime. But I think that is not what he and the majority of the people in his squad say what happened. It is, in fact, not a war crime to kill civilians unless you deliberately target them knowing that they are civilians.
Well, apparently one of the Navy SEALs said in the interview in 60 Minutes that they knew that, for example, the baby that they killed at the end who was crying was a baby.
Well, again, one of six or seven. One has to look at, you know, what his veracity might be. I mean, maybe he is telling the truth. And it does seem to me that this is something that the Pentagon should look at to determine what is known about this situation. But I think, you know, we're getting into a situation here where we're assuming that Senator Kerry was engaged in a war crime merely because civilians were killed, and that's not the state of the law.
Well, we are going to break for stations to identify themselves. I want to thank you both for being on. When we come back, we're going to hear for a few minutes from Lisa Calvillage, who took a very different approach during the Vietnam War, and then a debate on the book that has just come out by Christopher Hitchens called The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Should he be put on trial for war crimes? Reed Brody, Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch, and Lee Casey has written a series of editorials in Wall Street Journal Europe to the Heritage Foundation and is opposed to the International Criminal Court. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
So know what it is to be charged with mass guilt. Once in a lifetime is enough for me. No, I couldn't take it for a second time, and that's why I am here today. Even to May 25th, day of our protest, put a small balance weight on the other side. Hopefully someday my contribution to peace will help just a bit to turn the tide. Perhaps I can tell my children six later on their own children, but at least in the future they need not be silent when they're asked, where was your mother?
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. So we are joined on the phone right now by Lisa Calvillage, the woman who blocked a shipment of napalm during the war. The song that Pete Seeger wrote about her was actually inspired by the court transcript of her statement about why she chose to engage in that civil disobedience. She's now 78 years old and lives in California. Very briefly, your story, Lisa Calvillage, what you did during the Vietnam War.
Hello?
Hi.
Yes.
Your story, what you did during the Vietnam War.
Well, I do have to say that, you know, it was space that I accepted after a real a lot of soul searching when I was in this country, that everybody is responsible for what happened in that country. And as they said in the Pete Seeger song, when I first heard this in 1947 in Nuremberg, what is the town I was born and raised and where the tribunal was, I totally rejected the idea that we are all guilty. And I felt we were betrayed by our country, by our government, and the people who were on trial, you know, correctly, because they caused all this trouble. But daily and daily, there was no other radio than those reporting, and they were talking about, you German people, you're all guilty, that's mass guilt. And as I said, I rejected it. But after I came to the United States and people were asking me about it and said, what did you do when this was going on? And I said, I was a child. I was a teenager. Well, what did your father and mother do? And the people here have been totally ignorant what it means to live under a total dictatorship where the press, everything was controlled. Then I accepted the fact that, yes, we have to take responsibility, watching what happens going on. And, of course, the war in Vietnam started, and I felt also betrayed after Lyndon Johnson said American boys shouldn't fight where Asian boys should fight, and young men were sent over. And I decided that I had to say something now. I couldn't be silent like my parents were, even they had no anything to say under the Hitler government. And so together with three other women, we belong to the San Jose Peace Center, we decided to make a public protest. And at that time in the South Bay near San Jose, it's the end of the bay, there were napalm bombs stored. They were built at United Technology in Redwood City, and every night barges brought them down to that storage area. And then when they had enough for a shipment to Vietnam, what was a tremendous number, they would be taken back to Port Chicago, what is in the North Bay, and put on warships and so on and taken to Vietnam. And so that's what we did. We went there. We were aware of what's going on. We went there. We crawled through a fence and sat down in front of a forklift. We knew that we would not stop the war in Vietnam. I mean, we didn't have this illusion. But we also knew that a lot of people didn't know what was going on. The government is very secretive. They put those barges in at night. The general anti-war movement was carried on campuses, college campuses, and by what people thought, oh, the hippies. So we felt we were some highly respected housewives. We were very middle class. We had 14 children between the four of us, and our husbands all were in very good positions, mean typical middle class. So we decided if we could make an impact on the general population, and it really worked. We did get arrested. We were taken to jail. We were handcuffed. We had to get disinfected. And finally, in the afternoon, when we had a special arraignment, we were taken to the court looking just horrendous. And that really was in all the papers, and it made a tremendous impression. And then we had this trial. The trial lasted 5 days. I used as my defense the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, where that people were told, when you know something is wrong, you cannot be silent. You cannot say, I only followed orders. You must do something, and that's why I did it. And, you know, we did get 90 days in jail suspended. We never had to serve it any day. But nevertheless, what we really wanted to do, it became news all over the country, from coast to coast. And as I said, it is still there. And then Pete Seeger took the press release, what I gave after sentencing, and what is almost verbatim what the song says. And Pete Seeger asked my permission to put it in song, and it became then a record. And it's newly released. But we really believe that from then on, the anti-war movement really took off. We were invited in every place. Even the Rotaries invited us to speak to them.
Lisa Kavalaj, as you listen to the revelations about the former Nebraska Senator Bob Kerrey, what is your response? Do you think he's guilty of war crimes?
Well, you know, I do believe that the people who sent him, you know, can either just think that we are all responsible, that he should have said no. Yes, this is one thing, what I really felt when I did my protest. On the other hand, I know those people were sent over, and we heard all this stuff about the free fire zone and the incredible danger they were in and so forth. And I think the people who sent those people there, them, Kerry, and 50,000 Americans who died, and 800,000 GIs who came back maimed on body and soul, the people who sent those, the McNamara's, the Kissinger's, yes, those are people, what I consider the chief criminals. They should be tried first. I very firmly believe that.
Well, I want to thank you, Lisa Kavalaj, for joining us. Lisa Kavalaj, again, a woman from Germany who comes from Nuremberg and who tried to stop a shipment of napalm to Vietnam, on whom the Pete Seeger song, My Name is Lisa Kavalaj, is based. And we're going to go now to that issue of the people, the architects who sent the soldiers to Vietnam, as we are joined by Christopher Hitchens. His latest book is called The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Christopher Hitchens writes for Vanity Fair and The Nation magazine. Among the earlier books he's written, The Missionary Position, No One Left to Lie to, and Unacknowledged Legislation. Again, the latest book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger. And as you listen to Lisa Kavalaj and you complete your investigation of Henry Kissinger, what are your thoughts about war crimes?
Well, I must say, it was so wonderful listening to her, and the pluck on the one hand and the common sense on the other, and also the refusal to take refuge in euphemism or in excuses and say, well, there's nothing anyone can do, or it's all too complicated. Some things actually, though they are complex, needn't be confusing, and there's no need to add additional confusion. And, well, I'm very grateful to her for introducing the name Henry Kissinger, because that's the name on my lips at the moment as these things come up. Let's just take the example of Bob Kerry, who's the president of the school where I teach part-time, among other things. What he and his men did in that village that night was part of a thing called Operation Speedy Express, which was ordered from on high by Henry Kissinger, was National Security Advisor at the time. It was an attempt basically to cleanse the Mekong Delta. And Kevin Buckley of Newsweek wrote a brilliant series of pieces about it at the time, in real time, saying, look, the body count claims for this sweep of the Delta are enormous. I have a chunk about this in my book. Thousands and thousands of people, more than had been claimed originally as having been Viet Cong to begin with. Huge mounds of bodies. But, he said, captured weapons seem to be almost none. Strange. How can this be? I mean, that's how he got onto it. And after a bit, the figures began to make sense and to, so to speak, add up or not add up. And it became clear that what was going on was a war of extermination against the civilian population. And you'll note that the citation for Bob Kerry's Bronze Star for that operation says, it's in a sort of horrible little code. It says 21VCKIABC, which translates as 21 Viet Cong killed in action, brackets, body count, that's the BC. That's what he got the Bronze Star for. So, it is true to say he was acting under orders. I mean, that is not in his case. An excuse, and in his answer to your question, I believe in part, he's saying he doesn't want to shift responsibility from himself to anyone else. But it would be true to say that he was under orders, as were all of the fighters in that campaign. Now, the person who was responsible for that is currently, you know, an honored guest on the Society pages and has a column in the Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post and is a consultant to Nightline and people like that, and is thought of as an independent expert on foreign policy. But you cannot go near the arguments about the destruction of Indochina, the ramifications of the Pinochet case, the horrific disclosures in East Timor, the very strong likelihood of another war breaking out in Cyprus, the terrible situation still in Bangladesh where war crimes and atrocity trials are taking place at the moment. You can't turn over a body and have a look in any of these areas without finding Henry Kissinger's fingerprints. It's as bad as that. It's a one-man international rolling crime wave, as Nixon's understudy and toady, that went on for years and was not stopped and has never been punished, and as a result of which we have to all the time find ourselves stuttering and barking and trying to think of intelligent ways to talk about things like the Kerry case.
Michael Scharf is on the phone with us. He's a professor of law at the New England School of Law. He was a State Department official responsible for war crimes issues under the first Bush administration. He also served as a consultant to the International Criminal Tribunals in Rwanda and Yugoslavia. Do you think that Henry Kissinger should be put on trial for war crimes, crimes against humanity?
Begin focusing on the Bob Kerry issue and then go to the broader issue of Henry Kissinger. What's unusual about the Bob Kerry issue is that he has made some very strange public statements in the last couple of weeks about this. One is he has admitted that he took part in an atrocity, but said that that didn't mean that he was legally culpable. That's weird because atrocity is just layman terms for war crime, just like ethnic cleansing is layman terms for genocide or crimes against humanity. So if his lawyer was there when he made that statement, I'm sure he would have been turning green. The second thing he said was that he was not educated, nor were his troops, about what were war crimes. They weren't told what they could and they could not do. They were just sent in to do this operation. And that also is inconsistent with what was proven very well in the Lieutenant Calley case, and that is that our troops were told what was a war crime, and they knew that they had a duty not to obey illegal orders. And in the Lieutenant Calley case in particular, they found that you could not claim that an order to kill an innocent baby who was unarmed and obviously not in any way, shape, or form a combatant was an illegal order, and it was clearly and manifestly illegal. And so his failure to disobey that order got him in
legal trouble, and he had to go to jail for several years. Now, if that is applied to Kerry, and if the facts are as what have been claimed, Kerry may be facing some real problems. Now, looking at the broader picture of Henry Kissinger, you know, the Vietnam War was a flawed war, and it's something that for 30 years we've all regretted. But one of the problems with the war is that the North Vietnamese, which were the combatants and the Viet Cong and their supporters, they didn't wear distinctive uniforms, which is one of the requirements to be protected and to have special status under the Geneva Conventions. And so, therefore, when U.S. troops were going into these hot zones and they were taking enemy fire and it was in the middle of the night and their job was to try to clear out the enemy, there were a lot of civilian casualties. Those under the Geneva Conventions would be acceptable collateral damage, especially since the North Vietnamese were not wearing these distinctive uniforms, and so it wasn't clear who was and who was not the enemy. It does become clear when you talk about killing little infants, but even teenagers were known to lob hand grenades and to be snipers in this war, and so there were a lot of young people and very old people who were probably innocent civilians that were casualties of the war because of the way this war was fought.
I have to say, I think that that's rather grotesque.
Christopher Hitchens.
Most of the damage inflicted on civilians in Vietnam was by means of aerial bombardment. Now, it's true, that doesn't really, in other words, go to Professor Scharf's bizarre allegation that the Vietnamese are sneaky types who kind of, in their own country, by the way, and in the villages where they live and are born, don't have the courage to sort of get a proper military uniform on, and thus have to take anything that's coming to them. I'm reeling actually from hearing that. Let me kind of compose myself. Telford Taylor, who was the chief U.S. military prosecutor at Nuremberg, wrote a wonderful book which I have excerpted almost to the point of plagiarism in my own book because it's so powerful. Saying that look, by the standards that we insisted upon for the trial of the Nazi war criminals, and also for the Japanese Imperial General Staff, we are in danger of putting ourselves in the dock because of the mass destruction of society from the air by bombardment. This is not the picture that people like to summon up of an American soldier somehow caught in a firefight, perhaps in the dark, shooting back, and then finding to his horror that he's hurt some innocent people. This was a systematic business, as I was also saying about Operation Speedy Express, which was also a ground operation. And it considered civilians the enemy. That's a political point, because they were fighting a civilian insurgency. But it treated everyone as if they were a potential cadaver. And that's criminal by any standard. And look, you don't have to tell, under a uniform code of military justice, somebody, by the way, bear in mind it's illegal to shoot a baby. Quite a lot of people know that without being told. And I think the standard we should try and uphold here is that of someone now, alas, dead, who was a friend of mine, Ron Reidenhauer, who got wind. He was a Texan grunt, GI, got wind of what had happened at My Lai and interviewed fellow soldiers and brought evidence together and tried to get the legal officers of the armed forces interested in a prosecution. Colin Powell actually was one of those who told him to get lost and continued to cover up the My Lai episode, so he finally went to the press, but no one had to tell him what was right and what was wrong.
Yeah, let me respond to that. You've heard the old expression, all's fair in love and war. Obviously, that's not true for war, because the Geneva Conventions specify what is and what is not allowed in war. But these rules in war can't be at such a high standard that it's impossible to fight a conflict. And so, therefore, they don't prohibit everything in war. In fact, there is a giant loophole, and that is that certain things can be justified by military necessity. What they do prohibit is purposely targeting civilians as civilians or committing acts of torture against civilians. But if you look at Telford Taylor's book, and I'm looking at the particular pages that you're citing now, what he's focusing on is the bombing of civilian areas suspected of harboring guerrillas. And in fact, that would not be an indictable offense under the Geneva Conventions, because if there was evidence that these were areas that there were combatants using as headquarters, that these were areas the combatants were using as a launching ground, then these would have been legitimate targets under the laws of war. Now, morally, you know, what happened in Vietnam is regrettable. It's reprehensible. I was myself very much an opponent of Vietnam and the way that war was fought. But when you talk about the legal argument against Henry Kissinger and against our policy, it's not that easy a case to make.
Well, I have to, I'll concede this much. There is a problem also under the Nuremberg standards with aerial bombardment because for partly, I'm afraid, for cynical reasons, because the Allies had conducted so much aerial bombardment themselves. That isn't specifically charged or nominated as a war crime in the Nuremberg Bill of Indictment. And as a result, there are some shady areas, I grant you, on this point. But however, if, for example, the bombing is conducted by B-52s, which fly too high to be seen from the ground and carry enormous payloads, which is, I believe, the origin of the term carpet bombing. They lay down a sort of horrific carpet of high explosive from high up. They can't be heard when they're on their way. No one has the chance to take cover. There's no possibility of an air raid warning. You can't tell civilians, you know, we don't like this area. We think the enemy's there. You better get out of the way. None of that. You just devastate the entire society and ecology. Well, I think you have crossed a Geneva Convention line there. In fact,
right.
I think you crossed it very explicitly.
Now, Christopher, you're not saying, are you, that Henry Kissinger designed the strategy of carpet bombing, that he commanded and ordered the troops to do that. That was not his.
Well, I say very explicitly and in round terms, and it's been done by other people other than me. I'm not the finder of fact in this matter. He very intimately and personally supervised the bombardment of Cambodia something that's hardly even proper to call a war, since Congress didn't even know about it, let alone have the chance to declare it.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll not only look at Vietnam, but places like Chile and Henry Kissinger's culpability there, and also talk about, well, Christopher Hitchens, if you know what Henry Kissinger's reaction to the possibility of being taken like Pinochet if he were to leave the country. We did try to get Henry Kissinger on or someone from Kissinger Associates, but they did not get back to us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Our guest, Christopher Hitchens. His book is The Trial of Henry Kissinger. And Michael Scharf, professor of law at New England School of Law and an expert on the issue of war crimes. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests are Christopher Hitchens in the studio. His book is called The Trial of Henry Kissinger, and Michael Scharf, professor of law at New England School of Law. He was the official within the Bush State Department, that's George I, responsible for war crimes issues, and has also served as a consultant on the international criminal tribunals in Rwanda and Yugoslavia. With the detention of Augusto Pinochet, intense pressure for Slobodan Milosevic, most recently, just yesterday, George Bush II calling on Kostunica, the Yugoslav president, to extradite Milosevic to The Hague. The possibility of international law acting against tyrants around the world is emerging as a reality. And today we're looking again at Henry Kissinger. Christopher Hitchens, the response of Henry Kissinger to your call for his trial. Again, we did ask for him or one of his associates to be on from Kissinger Associates. They ultimately did get back to us and said no.
I haven't been able to get anyone much from their side to come out to play on this. I mean, I imagine that if I was Kissinger, I would think, well, I got away with the crimes, so I'll probably get away, and most of them were conducted in plain view, so I'll probably get away with somebody writing about them. And that would, actually, that's quite a shrewd bet on his part, except that the climate has somewhat changed. With the arrest of Pinochet particularly, two things have happened to condition the climate in which these things are discussed normally. One, universal jurisdiction has become much more the rule than the exception now. More and more countries are empowering their courts to consider those wanted for crimes against humanity as common enemies of the human race to be arrested and tried wherever they can be found. And there are a number of important precedents about this since Pinochet's arrest. I think the most important one was an Argentine death squad type who was picked up in Mexico. Instead of being returned to Argentina, he was sent to answer a warrant in Spain, which Mexico had never done before, third-party extradition. That's the first thing, is universal jurisdiction. There are very few places for people to hide anymore, and Henry Kissinger knows it, and I know takes legal advice about where and when he travels now, which gives me a slight little holiday in my heart, I must say.
What do you mean, takes advice?
Well, he consults lawyers. He got very alarmed, and I have a tape in my book of how alarmed he was. He's talking to his publisher, Michael Korda, on the day that the New York Times published the very, very highly embarrassing disclosures of United States government complicity with Pinochet's death squad operation, with Operation Condor, the internationalization of the death squad principle through the Chilean, Argentine, Paraguayan, Uruguayan, and Brazilian secret police to track down dissidents hemispherically and kill them, murder them. One of the most celebrated ones, of course, being right down in Washington, D.C. During the rush hour, the car bombing of Orlando Letelier. The second important thing about the new climate, the post-Pinochet climate, is this. The defense that such a person can make if arrested, that I did it because I was in government at the time, is known as sovereign immunity, has been struck down by the British House of Lords. And that precedent for the moment, I think, would hold in a lot of cases. It's much, much harder now to say, well, all right, I was responsible for this or that action of torture or kidnap or disappearance, but I was the head of the government, so that's okay.
You speak specifically about a man that Henry Kissinger was directly implicated in killing in Chile.
Yes. Now, here's the case. You don't need, in my opinion, any new law for this. There's no need to have anything fancy about international war crimes or crimes against humanity or the Geneva Convention or anything. It's the same as the original prohibition against murder. Henry Kissinger sat in a room and decided to remove from the scene General René Schneider, who was the constitutionally minded conservative officer who headed the Chilean general staff at the time. He was the principal obstacle to a coup to overthrow the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende. So it was decided to whack him, basically, to have him taken out.
Henry Kissinger was National Security Advisor under Nixon at the time.
National Security Advisor. Chile was a country with which the United States was not at war, was a democracy, with which we had diplomatic relations, as far as the ambassador to and from Chile knew. Good trade relations, excellent history of bilateral friendship. And they decide we want to have a coup in this country because there are some powerful interests influential with Nixon who didn't like the outcome of the Chilean election. The obstacle to a coup is General Schneider. Very well, Schneider goes. And he went. They killed him. And we now know, thanks to Congressman Hinchey's investigations, but this took a long time to come out, that even after the murder was committed, another sum of money was paid after money had been paid beforehand and guns donated to the gang that committed this revolting crime. Money was paid to them afterwards. So all the arguments that there used to be about, well, maybe they weren't really trying to kill him or they were only trying to kidnap him or frighten him and so on, it's all void now. We don't need to hear any more of that euphemism or subject changing. They paid off the killers after they'd done the deal.
And how do you know Kissinger was in the room in the discussion?
Well, because I have all the memos that he sent to Chile, urging them to keep up their efforts, saying, here are the guns, saying, here's some more money. And it's taken a long time in Washington, but through the Freedom of Information Act and the efforts of some excellent people like the National Security Archive, we can now say it's a lay-down case. I mean, we know every stage by which this outrage to democracy was conducted, but also by which what I would call the common crime of murder was committed, suborned, solicited, armed, paid for, and covered up.
Professor Michael Scharf, your response.
Reporting the facts, if you look at your book and what you've said, which I think you were much more careful in your analysis than you're being today, There is nothing in your book or in the cables that you cite that were released in January 1999 that indicate that Kissinger ordered the death of General Snyder, that he gave weapons specifically for the killing of that general. What you have proven, I think, is that he said to the Pinochet regime that the U.S. is sympathetic to what Pinochet is trying to do in terms of trying to deal with these insurgents and these elements of his society that are political opponents of his regime, and that they approved of their general methods. But you haven't proven in any way a conspiracy or aiding and abetting in a criminal manner. And really what you've done is made the same case, I think, that could be made against Jim Baker in Yugoslavia. Jim Baker told Milosevic, look, do whatever you can to keep Yugoslavia from breaking up. We don't want to see another dissolution. And then once the Yugoslav forces started engaging in ethnic cleansing, Jim Baker said, we don't have a dog in that fight. And that also was seen as given a green light to proceed with the same kinds of atrocities that you argue Kissinger was giving a green light to proceed with in Chile. And so the case against Kissinger is no more than the case against Jim Baker.
Excuse me, Professor. I do not think you'll find that Jim Baker, of whom I was not a fan, I would say he was a problem for the administration you served rather than for me. But I don't think you'll find that Jim Baker was involved in shipping weapons, money, political encouragement, and cover to the death squads that Mr. Milosevic was employing. I don't think you will make that allegation against him, will you?
Well,
if so, I must say I'm very surprised to find you serving. I'm very surprised to find you serving in that State Department. If you make that allegation,
Jim Baker certainly was partly responsible for the arming up of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And again, April Gillespie, the ambassador, the spokesperson.
This isn't comparing like with like. Of course, Jim Baker was a morally null person. You must know that better than most people, having worked in his State Department. This is not the same as sitting in a room and deciding that a constitutional officer in a neighboring democracy, I stress, an ally of the United States with which it has formal diplomatic relations and is not at war, should be removed by force. Okay? None of the things you've mentioned come up to anything like that standard. I think you're simply trying to obfuscate.
Finishing a thought you said earlier about Kissinger sitting in a room with Michael Korda, his publisher, when these allegations came out of the U.S. complicity with the overthrow of Allende and the deaths of thousands of people. What did Kissinger actually say? You have a tape recording?
What I have is the tape of Michael Korda trying to reassure him that it may not be as bad as he thinks, and that perhaps there's no issue of jurisdiction.
On the issue of Timor, Kissinger's
On the issue of Timor, I think the crucial thing is probably the Genocide Convention, but there would be two other laws that were important here. Kissinger sat in the room. I keep saying in the room, but it really is true. He likes to do this hands-on. I almost think he has a relish for this sort of thing at the hands-on stage. He was in the room, so was President Ford, incidentally, with the Indonesian general staff, the military dictatorship of Indonesia at the time, on the day that the invasion of East Timor was, so to speak, inaugurated. It had been in preparation for some time. Everyone knew that it might occur, but that it did occur is due to the fact that Henry Kissinger approved of it in advance. Now, three laws, I think, were broken by the Indonesian annexation of East Timor. One, it was a Portuguese territory. Portugal was responsible to the United Nations for shepherding it to independence and, with luck, to democracy. So it's a gross violation of international law. It was as simple as that. They just tried to annex by force someone else's territory. Second, it was a violation of American law. The American Foreign Assistance Act forbids the use of those weapons for any purpose except external self-defense. And in the result, it was a gross violation of the Genocide Convention because it has been shown repeatedly that East Timor was subjugated by means of mass extermination by Indonesian soldiers and also the use of weapons such as food denial on a grand scale. Well, I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know, Amy, because you've been there, but Kissinger's responsible very, very, I say again, personally, very intimately at every stage of that horrific chain of events and has lied about it in the most grandiose yet pathetic way, and I'm able to expose all of his lies in the relevant chapter as well.
Michael Scharf, with these different cases, do you think there's enough evidence would be for a grand jury to indict, even if you don't believe in conviction?
No. No grand jury in the United States would indict, and even in most countries of the world, I don't think they would. There's no evidence that Kissinger ordered or directly participated in these crimes. And the universal jurisdiction that Christopher Hitchens is talking about has been applied in foreign countries against the Nazi leaders who took part in the Holocaust, the Yugoslavia architects of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, the Rwanda Hutu leaders who were responsible for the 94 genocide, and then the Chile president who specifically ordered the assassination and torture of the opponents of his regime. They have not been applied to people like Henry Kissinger, who were foreign ministers, who may have taken part in broad foreign policy issues, who may have been in the room when some of these things were discussed. Being in the room is not the same thing as being in the dock. And although he is morally culpable, this doesn't rise to the level of criminal culpability under universal jurisdiction.
Christopher Hitchens, your final statement.
Well, I don't think that the moral, the legal, the criminal, and the political have been very well distinguished in my opponent's closing remarks. I'll just repeat that. Henry Kissinger knowingly ordered and concealed from Congress and supervised himself the mass destruction of civilian society in Cambodia. Henry Kissinger, also without congressional authorization, ordered the removal of a democratic general in a democratic country who formed the obstacle to a plan for a fascist coup, had him whacked out, had him assassinated. Henry Kissinger approved in advance and subsequently helped arm, after the genocide had begun, the mass murder of the people of East Timor. If anyone thinks these are moral objections only, they are really saying, which is a noise we're hearing increasingly now from the right wing in Washington, that a war crime isn't a war crime if it's committed by an American. This is not even a double standard. Right? It's a parody of what international justice is and ought to be, and is becoming, I might add, because the net is tightening around people like Kissinger now, and he knows it.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us again. Christopher Hitchens, his book is The Trial of Henry Kissinger. Christopher Hitchens, a longtime reporter and columnist for Vanity Fair, The Nation, and has written a number of other books as well. Michael Scharf, professor of law at the New England School of Law. Scharf was the State Department official responsible for war crimes issues under the first George Bush administration. Also served as consultant to the International Criminal Tribunals in Rwanda and Yugoslavia. That does it for the program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to email us, you can send your email to mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Or you can write to us at Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio, 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 1005. And producers of today's show, Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Matthew Finch is our engineer sitting in for Anthony Sloan. Errol Maitland, our technical director. And we'll go out with the song we went in with, and that is the song of Lisa Kalvalich. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Must have been asked 100 times where I was, what I did in those years Hitler ruled our state. I said I was a child, but most a teenager, but that only continued to question.